We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
It's 2:43 on the Afternoon Magazine. When construction slows, there's less of a need for all of those massive yellow construction machines. Excavators, front loaders, skid steers, many of them are now on the block. That auctioneer to buyers and sellers at this heavy machinery auction in Longmont, Colorado, is getting quite a workout. Prices are another indicator of where the economy is headed. From Colorado Public Radio, Zachary Barr has more.
Ritchie Brothers bills itself as the largest industrial auctioneer, holding sales all over the world. At today's auction, a new piece of heavy equipment rumbles across a runway every minute and is then sold to the highest bidder. Bidders like Jim Culverwell from Arizona.
I've done it in the dirt all my life.
Culverwell's retired now, and he's looking for a deal he can resell for a profit.
Well, what I look for mostly is small crawler tractors, older motor graders.
Culverwell also pays close attention to everything else for sale. And so do others, like Dave Pate, the owner of a large construction company in southern Colorado. Pate says business is terrible, so today he's strictly a seller. Flipping through the auction catalog, he notices something that gets him really discouraged. 35 scrapers for sale, many nearly new.
Usually you might see a half a dozen scrapers, and usually they're all junk. The stuff I'm looking at out there looks like it's really nice stuff.
A scraper is an enormous machine. It churns up tons of dirt in seconds and then deposits that dirt somewhere else. It's like a giant self-loading dump truck. Now, the secondhand scraper market is volatile and telling because scrapers are mostly used just for the biggest jobs.
They're the first in on road building. They're the first in on a new subdivision. And when they're selling their stuff, they don't see nothing coming up.
So just how telling is the used scraper market as a leading economic indicator? Robert Frank is an economist who teaches at Cornell, and I tell him about all the scrapers getting auctioned off. He cautions against taking it too far.
Just because maybe there are fewer really big jobs, the ones where you'd use the scrapers, doesn't necessarily mean that overall activity is going to be depressed to the same degree.
It just means that the biggest jobs are not there.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the big jobs employ a lot more resources than the small jobs.
We're going to go down, and we're out of the motor graders, we're into the scrapers, ladies and gentlemen, some nice ones today, I'm telling you.
Back at the auction, the scrapers roll in, and it's like celebrities just walked in the door. Everyone stops what they're doing and stares. After all, a new scraper can cost $1 million.
Oh, six, low hours home. Here we go. Here we go. 350,000. 350,000. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, 250.
Prices for all used heavy equipment are down about 30% from where they were a year ago, and scraper prices have slipped even more. Just a year ago, a late model scraper would have set you back about $500,000.
So, 250,000.
The first one sells for $250,000. From there, prices plummet. One bidder waits patiently until the very last machine drives across the ramp. And then he nabs it for just $132,000. And to him, that says a lot about what's happening in his industry.
You can tell there's no dirt work out there at this time.
Shane Ollick's Nebraska company primarily hauls sugar beets, but recently fell into a side job that requires a scraper. Earlier today, Ollick gave his new purchase the once-over, but he wasn't able to examine it closely.
I don't know what's wrong with my machine. It seems like it was pretty reasonable, so maybe there's something wrong. I didn't see it.
Still, Ollick says, the price was so good that even if he has to spend another $100,000 to fix it up, he'll be all right. For NPR News, I'm Zachary Barr.
In Europe, traditional light bulbs are being phased out starting today. Those old incandescent light bulbs are seen as energy guzzlers. Replacing them in all 27 member countries is part of an EU plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions 20% by the year 2020. Eleanor Beardsley sends us this report.
Thomas Edison may be rolling over in his grave, but that won't stop Europe from switching off his light bulbs. While stores will be able to sell off their remaining stocks, starting today, the manufacture and import of the standard 100-watt and the frosted light bulb, deemed the most wasteful, will be banned. And over the next 3 years, all incandescent bulbs which create more heat than light will be phased out completely. A similar ban is set to begin in the U.S. in 2012. Under the new European law, incandescent bulbs will be replaced by more efficient lighting systems like fluorescent, halogen, or LED lamps, which can save up to 80% of the energy used by the old bulbs. The new lights will cost more but last longer, saving consumers money in the long run, says Ferran Taradellas, energy spokesman for the EU.
The equivalent of energy that we can save with this measure, it's equivalent to the electricity consumption of Romania. It could bring back to the European economy around 5 billion euros per year.
Still, the measure is not being taken lightly by everyone. Consumers in some countries, like Germany, are said to be stockpiling Thomas Edison's old-style bulbs for cost reasons or even out of nostalgia. EU Energy Commissioner Andris Piebalgs tried to reassure Europeans in his blog by telling them, much like the car and telephone took time to catch on, you will one day appreciate the new era of lighting. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
We'll stay in Europe for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It calls itself the biggest arts festival in the world. For an entire month, the Scottish capital fills up with talent and craziness in sometimes equal measure. Getting your work seen at the festival holds the promise of being discovered. NPR's Rob Gifford went to the Fringe this year and found one playwright for whom Edinburgh really has been a dream come true.
If you run the gauntlet of Edinburgh's Royal Mile during August, be prepared to be bounced like a pinball between the competing pitches for fringe shows. Dramatic apocalyptic horror, anyone?
Dramatic apocalyptic horror, folks! Four survivors in a world consumed by a plague of the walking dead? 5:10 tonight, Sweet in the Grass Market?
Or perhaps the new show from the London Gay Men's Chorus is more your scene.
We're doing Oklahoma. We're far from Kansas. We're the cabaret group of the London Gay Men's Chorus.
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
Brokeback meets Broadway.
O-K-M-A-H-O-M-O, Oklahoma.
Japanese comedians, German poets, Scottish tap dancers, School for Scandal from the 18th century, or Godspell from the 20th. It's all here, quite apart from the usual mix of bagpipers and sword swallowers that throng the sidewalks of the city. The reason they're here, says Sam Friedman, editor of the authoritative Fest magazine, is because the Edinburgh Fringe is quite simply the place to be discovered.
I think it is the main springboard in the UK. And I mean, more than a springboard, I would kind of describe it as a kind of one massive sprawling trade fair. I just, a few days ago, spent a day scouting with the head of BBC Radio Comedy here, and she's one of hundreds of scouts that come up to the Fringe looking for new talent.
Friedman says the problem is there's so much to see that it can be difficult to sort the gems from the dross. As far as theatre is concerned, he says each year there tends to be one play that grabs the headlines and the awards. Last year, it was a play called Eight by an unknown 23-year-old writer called Ella Hickson. This year, the hot ticket has been a play called Precious Little Talent by a slightly better-known 24-year-old writer called Ella Hickson. Friedman says Hickson epitomises what Edinburgh is all about.
Ella is a young and exciting playwright, and I think it's particularly because she's basically living the fringe dream, essentially. You know, she'd never written anything in her life before last year, and within a few weeks of the festival, she was the talk of the entire festival. She'd won awards, you know, she got a run off Broadway, she got a run in the West End, and I think therefore, you know, people are very excited about her follow-up play this year.
I studied English at university and history of art, and I had a secret, sort of guilty secret, that I wanted to write. I'd always written poetry and prose and things, but had the background and the education that dictated I was probably going to be a blonde doing PR somewhere.
Ella Hickson herself is disarmingly modest, though she admits that, like most British people, she is quite cynical. And it was her British cynicism that was challenged when, while in the US in January for her first show's run off Broadway, a friend took her to Washington for President Obama's inauguration.
Everything in Britain felt quite underwhelming in terms of there weren't any jobs to be had, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I went to the inauguration, and there was a sort of mass swell of faith, and it was political faith, but it also was sort of a faith in change. And I felt jealous, essentially. I thought it's not really fair that us British kids, English kids, don't have that. that ability to believe and B, that figure to believe in.
So Hickson's new play, Precious Little Talent, has turned out to be something rather unusual in artistic circles, or any circles in Britain or Europe generally. A love letter to America and the American ability to believe and hope. The play centres on a cynical young British girl called Joey, who loses her job and flies to New York to visit her sick father. There she meets Sam, a young American whose idealism and belief in the need for heroes is as strong as her cynicism.
Huh? I think a hero is exactly what you're after. Someone to pick you up and dust you off and tell you everything's going to be all right.
Yeah, but it's not. We don't want heroes.
Yeah, because you don't need them?
Yeah, because we don't believe in them.
Because you can't believe in them.
Because they're not real.
Sam whisks Joey off to the Obama inauguration. There she sees complete strangers embracing each other on a freezing January day, and she sees the hope and optimism that she so clearly lacks. Slowly, the cynical English girl feels the thaw in her cold English bones. The plot leaves plenty of opportunities for playwright Hickson to skewer British and American foibles.
Sure, you know, there were differences. Sex, for example. I like the British kind. Passionate, angsty, but essentially joyless. And for him, well, it was more like going to the Oscars. Lots of tears and thank yous. And felt like he fought with an overwhelming urge to clap at the end.
But by the end, you feel cynical Joey really might change.
I'm not like them. I'm not flying the flag of revolution. I don't have fire in my belly and idealism on my tongue. And I'm not singing the song of change. And why? Because I don't know the words yet. But I will. I promise we will.
Bearing in mind the battering that President Obama has received in recent weeks, it's perhaps not a bad thing that Joey's transformation hangs in the balance. Ella Hickson is hoping to take this show to New York too, and she says it's not just a play. She really does hope that Britain can learn from America. And considering how her dreams have been realised here, that's perhaps not surprising.
The ethic in the play and in the journey I've had as a result of Edinburgh are incredibly similar. Edinburgh Festival, to me, is one of the very last and remaining truly democratic institutions out there. Anyone can come. Everybody has the same opportunity to be noticed and to be taken somewhere. And that, to me, is so worth defending. So, long live Edinburgh, I say.
Rob Gifford, NPR News, Edinburgh.
Today's programs are made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For 20 years, Silver Creek has served fresh and seasonally current dinners by the fireplace in warm wood ambience. Silver Creek offers over 100 of the world's finest wines and draft beers.
Earth and Sky.
Denise Bode is CEO of the American Wind Energy Association in Washington, D.C. Bode spoke to Earth Sky about the growth of wind power in the U.S.
The U.S. is number one in the world as of this year in terms of developing wind generation.
Bode spoke of a new report by the Department of Energy that found about 30% of the world's wind power is produced in the U.S., which led with over 25,000 megawatts in 2008.
But right behind us is China, in terms of fastest growing new countries. But China is growing so exponentially because their policies require renewable generation to be added to their portfolio.
Bode expressed concern that the U.S. lacks a renewable electric standard. That's a set of laws that require utilities to get a certain percentage of electricity from renewable sources like wind and solar each year.
Wind is clean. It avoids carbon, so it is an environmental policy. It uses little water, can save consumers money. And I think if we get this industrial policy in place of a renewable electric standard, we can be the bright new spot in the economy, adding a huge number of manufacturing jobs.
Manufacturing jobs to build and assemble the over 8,000 parts of a wind turbine. More on our website, Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
It's about 2.5 minutes before 3 o'clock, and tomorrow Celeste Quinn comes back to the anchor chair here on the Afternoon Magazine, and in the 1 o'clock hour, she'll be talking to the producers of the new WILL-TV documentary, Red Grange Remembers, Highlights and Reflections of Football's First Superstar. That is Coming up September 8th at 7 o'clock on WILL-TV, Celeste will talk with producer Denise LaGrassa and assistant John Paul, as well as Kemper Peacock, the former TV sports producer who interviewed Red Grange. I believe that was back in 1982. Some of the lost portions of that interview are coming up on that